So here we are, third day of Unleavened Bread. I guess I'll start by stating the obvious, huh? The title of the sermon is In the Wilderness. You know, there's an entire book in the Torah, the book of Numbers, that is about the wilderness. And actually, the Hebrew title for the book is not Numbers, but Bemidbar, which is to say In the Wilderness. And so let's turn there just briefly as we're talking about the Israelites and how God intervened to extract them from their captivity. Numbers chapter 33, until Thursday, it was my intention to, one of my main points early on was to make the point that what's going on in Exodus at this time began with Moses, Abraham and Ur of the Chaldees. And since that point was pretty well covered on Thursday, I had to rearrange things just a little bit. But that's all right. Some things perhaps need to be reemphasized. But let's notice Numbers 33, because this is a nice, precise outline of the various campsites and the travels that Israel went through as they left Egypt. Chapter 33, verse 1. These are the journeys of the children of Israel who went out of the land of Egypt by their armies under the hand of Moses and Aaron. Now Moses wrote down the starting points of their journeys at the command of the Eternal, of Jehovah, the Lord. And these are the journeys according to their starting points. They departed from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the first month. On the day after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with boldness in the sight of all the Egyptians. Yes, I suspect they were quite bold, as a matter of fact. Be glad to be rid of that horrible rigor they were under. Verse 4, for the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord Jehovah had killed among them. Also, on their gods, the Lord had executed judgment. So, in one respect, the plagues were against the gods of Egypt as well, demonstrating that the God of Israel was much more powerful than the God of Egypt, because they had multiple gods. So, verse 5, the children of Israel moved from Ramses and camped in Sukkot. All right, day 1, moved from Ramses to Sukkot. Then, verse 6, they departed from Sukkot and camped at Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. All right, so now they're 2 days out and they're on the edge of the wilderness. And then they moved from Etham and turned back to Pi-hahiroth, which is east of Baal-zephon, and they camped near Migdol. Now, so that's day 3. And they departed from before Hahiroth and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness and went 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Etham and camped at Marah. All right, so there you have the exodus out of Egypt. And God led them deliberately into the wilderness. And there's reason for that, I think, and I don't think we have to speculate too loudly or too wildly to understand why he would have done that, why he did it, looking back with historically, especially. Let's turn to Exodus 13. So, because, there was a direct route to the promised land, and what God is doing here with this Exodus is in the process of fulfilling the promises that he gave to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and so on. And the descendants of Abraham have been multiplied greatly. There's, do the math, roughly 2 million by this time, and going to get larger as time goes on. And he is delivering them just as he promised. But notice chapter 13 of Exodus, and beginning in verse 17. It says, then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Now, that's interesting. Evidently, you could expect that the Philistines would be trouble. They would cause, maybe they would see vulnerable people and try to take advantage. But there was this concern, and you see it crop up time and again throughout the narrative, lest perhaps the people change their minds and return to Egypt. Now, that's going to come up numerous times in the account as we go through it. And you recognize that the people had a tendency to lose their focus. And here's the instruction from God, and yea, verily, we've been extracted from slavery and liberated. And yet the first little trial comes along, we get distracted, and we become negative, and we're no longer bold, if you will, no longer excited, and now we're whining and moaning and complaining. So evidently, this was a tendency God perhaps was anticipating. But nevertheless, into the wilderness they went. So verse 18, so God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. And the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. Now, it's interesting, you think about what they had put up with. You know, Abraham was told, and we'll touch on that a little bit, that it would be a long time before these promises were fulfilled. But, you know, how did, just for a moment, let's recall how it was that Israel ended up in Egypt in the first place. And again, you go back to the story of Genesis and Joseph, one of the younger sons of Isaac, not the youngest as Benjamin was, but Joseph was seen having dreams and interpreting these dreams, and his brothers weren't too happy with the whole prospect, so they decided they'd get rid of him. I mean, he was Jacob's favorite after all, and they didn't like that, so they sold him into slavery, and that's how Joseph ended up there. And of course, you, by way of circumstances, God worked with Joseph, and lo and behold, he becomes, you know, Pharaoh's second-hand man, if you will. And just at the time when there would be a time of plenty, 7 years of plenty, according to the dreams that God had allowed Joseph to interpret, and then 7 years of famine. And so it was Joseph that engineered the process of setting aside the surplus, and it was during the famine that Israel, Jacob, and his sons and their families ended up in Egypt. And it was all well and good for the time, because Pharaoh was favorable to Joseph, of course, and Joseph's family, and it all went well, and so they got established in the land Goshen, part of Egypt. And then they started to grow, and multiply their population and the like, so they become established in Egypt. And then, of course, Joseph died. The Pharaoh who knew them and was favorable to them, he dies, and you get a Pharaoh now that is not at all pleasant toward them. And we'll pick up the story in Exodus chapter 1. And so by this time, the population evidently has expanded quite a bit, and Pharaoh's taking note. Chapter 1, verse 8 of Exodus, and there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. All right, so this is going to cause trouble. And he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. So come, he says, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go out of the land. So Israel, their population is growing, and they're seen as a potential enemy in the event of war. Pharaoh was concerned that they might ally themselves with some invading army and be troublesome, and so he wanted to do something about that. Well, okay, what did he do? Well, verse 11, therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. All right, now, once again, you see, he's concerned about Israel and about losing them. You know, they multiply and they go out of the land. In the event that there was a war, they would leave. Now, recognize in ancient times, even up to, well, till the point where we became proficient at utilizing fossil fuels, the primary energy for building empires was muscle, human muscle, animal muscle, and what engineering they could put together. And so to lose Israel. I mean, they put them into slavery, and now it becomes a primary energy source to carry out Pharaoh's building projects and the like. And of course, he wouldn't be too anxious to, he wouldn't want to lose that source of labor. Now, at some point in time, verse 11, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. So there came a day when taskmasters, what does that mean? I mean, it's like an invasion. Pharaoh sends in his armies, and bingo, you know, suddenly you are a captive people. Suddenly you are an enslaved people, not unlike, you know, Nazi Germany pulling into Poland and from Poland into, you know, Norway and Denmark and Belgium and so forth. France taking over the whole works. At some point in time, you send in an occupying army, because I don't suppose people want to come up under taskmasters and become slaves voluntarily. But this is what was happening. So verse 12, the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. That's interesting. But nevertheless, they were in dread of the children of Israel. So Egypt's dread continued to grow as the population seemed to prosper in spite of their burdens. Verse 13, so the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. All right. So now, of course, God knows what's going on, and he can see this, and God will indeed intervene at some point, and even now begins to intervene. I always find it interesting to see God's starting point when he decides to intervene. So how does God intervene in removing the affliction and liberating the children of Israel from their captivity in Egypt? Well, a child is born. Chapter 2, Moses is born, all right? And you saw, so it's interesting. Moses will be 40 years in Egypt. And then because of his, well, his short fuse, I guess, and he kills an Egyptian who was afflicting a Hebrew and had to flee the country. Ended up in Midian, where he married and served his father-in-law for 40 years as a shepherd. I always find that interesting. 40 years in Egypt, 40 years to learn a new way of life in Midian, out in the desert someplace. So it's as though he had to unlearn all of his Egyptian qualities. I mean, he was raised in the court of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's daughter dragged him, pulled him out of the Nile River, and he became a member of the household. So after 40 years, you know, he's thoroughly Egyptian. He looks like an Egyptian. He talks like an Egyptian. He dresses like an Egyptian. For all intent and purposes, he is an Egyptian. So 40 years of, you know, herding sheep, then you get a whole different perspective on life when you're dealing with livestock as opposed to being the prince of Egypt. So the people are enslaved. Now, this Moses, this child that's born here in chapter 2, that child is going to return one day at the age of 80 to be the instrument with which God will extract the people from Egypt. Now think about that. In all likelihood then, every single human being, every single Israelite in this case, in Egypt at this point, at the point that Moses was born, would die. They wouldn't be even around. It'd be a whole new generation or two, or three maybe, by the time Moses was finally dispatched to be the instrument, like I say, to extract the people from slavery. So God can see the end, and we're wondering what, you know, what's going on, and God's in the process of sorting things out and beginning the process of liberation. So it's, you know, it's kind of interesting. I wouldn't have done it that way. You know, if you're going to liberate them, go liberate them. Why mess around for 80 years? Well, you know, after a while, you quit asking why. That's been my experience anyway. And it's the human proclivity, of course, to want to question God. Well, why did he do it that way? Well, why did he do it the other way? Well, we read the history, and I guess it's human nature to want to second-guess the history and the narrative as it's presented to us. But matter of fact, this is the way he did it, and it worked out fairly well to support his purpose. Now, so here we are. We're in the process of beginning the extraction, because it's Moses is going to be the one that does it. Now, just for a moment, I want to go back to Genesis chapter 15 and note a couple of things relative to Abraham. And like I say, these things were covered in some detail Thursday, so I won't spend a lot of time here, but I do want to take a look here at a couple of things. So in the 15th chapter of Genesis, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward." But Abram said, "Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir in my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" See, Abraham, well, he will become Abraham. He's still Abram at this time. He comes out of Ur of the Chaldees, and he's promised to be, he'll become a great nation. And here he is sometime later, and he still has no heir. And so he just assumes, well, this Eliezer born in my house here, he'll be the heir. No, Abraham, you don't get the point, God's telling him. He says in verse 3, or verse 4, "Behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. Then he brought him outside and said," all right, now here's what it's going to look like. No, you don't have an heir yet, but here we are, light pollution in this part of the world at that time, I'm sure. So it's a star-studded night, and God says to Abraham, "Now look up into the heavens. See, count the stars if you're able." And this is what I mean when I say I'm going to multiply your descendants. He said to him, "So shall your descendants be." And he believed in the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. So now, is that it? Is that now from this? Description here, one might conclude that all you have to do is believe and you're righteous. I believe. You know? And in fact, there are those who claim that that's all you have to do anyway. I believe, and then you're saved. Well, all right. Moses now wrote the book of Genesis, if we understand correctly, and Moses has the whole story. Abraham served God for 100 years. Yes, it will turn out from his subsequent actions, his behavior, and his dedication to God that indeed he did believe. He was righteous because of that, but it would be a lifetime of service demonstrating to God that he was loyal, that he wouldn't be turned astray. He wouldn't lose his focus. Well, he had his issues from time to time, but in the long run, he did indeed do what God wanted him to do. And of course, we can be encouraged by that, because it's God's desire that we should all come to fulfill the purpose for which he created humanity in the first place. Now, Abraham will, over time, demonstrate that he does believe. His actions will demonstrate it. And so, he says in verse 13, of this same chapter. Now notice, God said to Abraham then, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. All right. I guess it's an understatement to say that Abraham realized this wasn't going to come to pass in his lifetime. And I think that's not hard to see, is it? It's going to be 400 years. Now give us some kind of perspective on 400 years. Speaking from an American perspective, I'll ask forgiveness for our provincial approach here, us Americans. But nevertheless, this is 2020. 400 years ago was 1620. That's the year the Pilgrims landed, the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth in Massachusetts. 1620, 400 years. So what can happen in 400 years? Well, of course, there were natives populations across the continent, but pretty sparsely populated by today's standards. So over the course of 400 years, we've grown to a population of 330 million or so. We're currently in the process of doing the 2020 census even now. So we'll get a better figure of handle on just exactly what the population is now in 2020. And so 400 years. And so Moses Moses, first of all, Abraham recognizes that, all right, God promises him that this will happen. And of course, the story is he did indeed have a child, and it wasn't just, you know, his child. I mean, it was to come through Sarah as well. Now, the interesting thing about Isaac's the son of promise. Of course, you have this little episode in chapter 16 where after 10 years, no child, no heir, and Abraham and Sarah took matters into their own hands. Sarah suggests, well, why don't you take Hagar, my handmaid, and have a child by her? Maybe that's what God intends. Well, Abraham seemed to agree, and lo and behold, Hagar is born. Well, no, that's not what God had in mind. Abraham could argue, well, it's a child from my body. No, you're going to include Sarah as well. Now, the interesting part about the son of promise, Isaac, was that that was a miracle. It took a divine intervention into a marriage that was sterile, not fertile, and God had to intervene in order so that now, looking back on it, nobody can take credit for having engineered something one way or another. God was the one that engineered the child of promise that would lead to the Messiah, who would be a blessing, bring a blessing to all nations. And so it was when Isaac and Rebecca had twins, Jacob and Esau, and it was stated right up front that the younger Jacob, or the elder Esau, would serve the younger Jacob. That was prophesied before she even gave birth. And the whole point of that was that then Jacob was chosen from the womb, so not because of his superior position one way or another, but because God selected him. It's by election, you know, not by merit. And so that goes a long way, and that's the principle by which God works. Nobody's going to stand before God with his list of merits and say, look here, you owe me. No, it doesn't work that way. God doesn't work that way. None of that sort of thing. So, all right, let's notice now, back to the Exodus, chapter 6, just leading up to the time when God would begin working miracles in the form of plagues against Egypt to soften them up so that Pharaoh would agree to let them go. So, chapter 6 of Exodus. Now, remember, 400 years have gone by now, and the current crop of Israelites have been born into slavery generation after generation for, I think, well over 200 years now. And so they are thoroughly slaves, and that's all they've ever known. So then the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. Well, of course, he wasn't very cooperative to begin with, and didn't think he had to let them go. Didn't want them to go, obviously, because they were a major part of his economic system. So God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am Jehovah, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name Jehovah I was not known to them. I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of which pilgrimage in which they were strangers. All right, so he makes his covenant. The description is eventually they will take possession of the land from the river of Egypt, the Nile, all the way to the Euphrates. Well, that hasn't happened yet, not even under David and Solomon, but eventually it will take place. You know, we can, well, of course, again, with regard to Abraham, you know, clearly, he's the father of the faithful. And you ask yourself the question, well, which covenant was Abraham operating under? So Abraham clearly was involved with God, and God had a much greater purpose than just, you know, numbers of offspring, but he was the beginning. This is where God started. And God can see the big picture. He can work it out. We look at the circumstances around us, and we're not sure how things are going to work out. And, you know, we have to learn to trust God. That's what it's all about, learning to trust God. So I have established my covenant with them, verse 4, to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, in which they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. All right, so we're going to take some action now, and we're going to begin to deliver on our promise, even after 400 years. And that's what he said, so that's what he's doing. Verse 6, therefore say to the children of Israel, I am Jehovah. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from the bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. So the intervention is not going to be something hidden away in a closet somewhere. This is going to be great judgments, massive interventions, miracles of the first order, if you will. Verse 7, I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am Jehovah your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. That's the bottom line. You will be my people, I will be your God. That's the bottom line all the way from the time of Egypt right on down to now. So I will bring you into the land which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am Jehovah. All right? So there you have it. So here we are. Time to get involved. Now I want you to notice verse 9 in particular. You know, you read over these scriptures and these examples and time after time, and, you know, how many times have I done this? 50 years and more now. And you always, every now and again, you will run across something that you didn't see before. Now notice verse 9, Exodus 6. So Moses spoke thus to the children of Israel, but they did not heed Moses. All right, well, that's no surprise. We all familiar with the fact that they didn't heed Moses from time to time and all, you know, continuously. But now notice, he gives the reason why. Because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. Perhaps God understood that this generation, probably because of their anguish and their of spirit and the cruel bondage that was a part of their entire existence, that in this life, they may not, it may have been predisposed to wait till the resurrection, and that's when he would begin to deal with them. It does make me pause and perhaps soften my judgment of this people. I have no way of processing what it would be like to be born into slavery, abject slavery, rigorous subjection to cruel taskmaster. I have no way of processing that, none whatsoever. And I wouldn't pretend to. But so clearly, though, the impact was serious and it was, you know, very deep. And it's entirely possible that this particular generation was going to have to wait till the resurrection. Well, all right. History says that's what's going to happen. They will be resurrected. You know, you've got clear indications that the day is coming, you know, when God will reunite the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Ezekiel depicts it as two sticks. Put the sticks together, bind them up. And he's going to bring those two nations, those two houses back together again. There'll be one nation, one King David, all right, in the millennium. So we're looking forward to that. And so, again, when I focused on that point, I'm a little less anxious or a little slower to, you know, point the finger and judge harshly this generation of ex-slaves. Perhaps we need to be a little careful. Well, probably a good lesson, you know, for any situation. A whole lot less likely to judge. So I don't know what you call it, shell shock, PTSD. They're timid, unbelieving. This generation will ultimately perish in the wilderness. And perhaps that's just the way it had to be, and that's the way God would eventually work with them via the resurrection. Well, I guess you could say that's the way he's going to deal with most people, via the resurrection, the great fall harvest. All right, so Exodus 13, moving ahead. So we have this series of plagues, God is getting Pharaoh's attention, demonstrating that he's greater and more powerful than all the Egyptian gods. And of course, chapter 13, 12 and 13, you know, we have the story of the slaying of the firstborn. And with that, Pharaoh's spirit is completely broken, and that's enough. Get out of here. We don't, you know, get out of my sight. Let's pick up the story in chapter 13, verse 17. So it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. All right? You look at a map, you know, right out of Egypt and east a ways and turn north, and there you are, promised land. Now, why was that? Lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, that, and you'll see this come up several times in the narrative, that the children of Israel says, well, we'd been better off if we'd have just stayed in Egypt. And never mind the horrible rigor that they'd been in. I don't know that I can explain exactly that phenomenon and why that would be. But nevertheless, that was the tendency. It was right there. So continuing then, verse 18. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And the orderly ranks, I don't know if this is exactly the way it was set up in the book of Numbers, but the book of Numbers goes into detail as to how the whole nation was ordered by tribe. And when it came time to move, they moved up in an orderly fashion. So, verse 19, Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. So Joseph is going back home. Verse 20, so they took their journey from Sukkot and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness, as we saw in Numbers 33. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way. The Lord, that's Yahweh, okay, to lead the way. It was a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, so as to go by day and night. Verse 22, he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar by night from before the people. So it was God's intention to dwell in the midst of the people from the very beginning, and he was right there to lead the way. So we come to chapter 14. What we're going to learn is, there's more to this business of liberation from Egypt than just that, being free. Now you're no longer slaves. Now you can do what you want. In the United States, we call it life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. My life, I'll do as I please, thank you. All right, liberty, yeah, I'm free to do what I want. Pursuit of happiness, oh yes, that's what we're all about. So, but no, it goes a whole lot further than just being liberated from slavery, as we're going to see. And that's what we need to take into consideration. This is a lesson that they were going to learn or not, a lesson we have to learn or not, I suppose you could say. Chapter 14 then. So, first of all, before we go to chapter 14, let's go to chapter 19, because this is at they've arrived at Sinai, and God's going to enter into the covenant with them. And I want to focus here on the point that there's more to this business of liberation than just being free from slavery, because God has a purpose and a plan in mind, and this is what he's going to work out. So we're out of Egypt, we're on our way to Sinai via the wilderness, and God will work with us, and he's going to achieve his purpose. Well, now notice chapter 19 again. This is of Exodus. They've come to the to Sinai. Chapter 19 of Exodus. In the third month, after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. So, all right, so they're, you know, this is essentially a 50-day journey from Passover, Days of Unleavened Bread, to the Feast of Pentecost, if we have it correctly. I don't see any reason why that would not be right. Verse 2, for they had departed from Rephidim, had come to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians." I mean, this is fresh on their minds, just a matter of weeks since all these things happened. "How I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." Interesting, the phraseology, "I bore you on eagle's wings," but according to the story, they walked every step of the way. I'll call on poetic license here, perhaps, because I think it is a depiction of God's dedication to them and seeing to it that they got where they needed to go safely. Verse 5, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice," it isn't just a matter of me liberating you from slavery, now you can go do your own thing. "No, if you indeed obey my voice, keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine." All right. God has special things in mind for the descendants of Abraham. He's in the process of fulfilling his promises to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And here we are. Verse 6, "You shall be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." All right. Now, this is quite a vision God has for these ex-slaves. But his intent is to have a people, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. And that would be to serve him and to do what? And to then to serve other nations under God's guidance. So verse 7. "Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Lord commanded them. Then all the people answered together and said, 'All that the Lord has spoken, we will do.'" There you have it. We will do it. So Moses brought the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I come to you in the thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever." So Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. All right, we're going to enter into this agreement. All right, now let's go back to chapter 14. You see, once again, God has something more in mind than simply liberating people from slavery. And likewise, God has something in mind for us beyond just, you know, removing the death penalty, if you will. We come into a covenant with God, and it's not like we're liberated and we're free to do as we please. We are under a master of one sort or another. We're under the master, which is sin, until we're liberated from it. And then once we're liberated from it, what? Now, God is our master. It's not a matter of being without a master, doing your own thing. No, all human beings are under some master. We have the privilege, the opportunity to have God as our master. But recognize that. We haven't been liberated to do our own thing, however we might imagine that. Exodus 14. Pick it up in, verse 11. So, all right, well, first of all, they leave Egypt, all right. So they manage to get out into the wilderness, and Pharaoh has a change of heart, and he says, "Uh-oh, I can't let those people go. Let's go get them." So he loads up his chariots, and away they go. Of course, Israel is walking. Pharaoh's got his elite charioteers out there, so they're going to catch up in a pretty quick order. And so the Egyptians pursued them. This is verse 9. And sure enough, they caught them where they were camped out there by the sea at Pi-hahiroth before Baal-zephon. All right, now verse 10. "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes and beheld the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to their Lord." Ah, good. They cried out to God. That's a good start. They're in trouble. They know it, and they call out to God. "Then they said to Moses," uh-oh. So here we are, the proclivity to want to go back to Egypt. "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt?" Oh, have you forgotten? how hard and rigorous it was. You know, it's been, well, how, it's only been 3 or 4 days. Now they're in the wilderness, 3 days out of Egypt, and already they've forgotten. Well, maybe Egypt wasn't so bad. Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Wow. You know, it's. I guess it's hard to imagine, but this is the way they viewed it. And so the journey, once again, God has in mind, at least to start the process of creating a special people. He described them as a kingdom of priests. Now, we're starting with a bunch of ex-slaves. They've known nothing but slavery. And God is going to, he's got, this is what we have in this journey from Ramses to Sinai, 50 days essentially. What we have here is a crash course in learning to trust God. Because if you can't do that, then, as they say, all bets are off. The whole process begins and is determined by our ability to trust God, to have faith in God. Abraham is the father of the faithful. He learned to trust God. We must do the same. So, all right, here they are, wishing that they'd stayed in Egypt. So Moses said to the people, verse 13, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, of the Lord, of Jehovah, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you will hold your peace. All right, so here we are then. We have this opportunity. Now this is... here's our first chance to trust God. Well, not the first, but certainly the next. First one out of Egypt, at least. So the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. Lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. All right, so a miracle by any reckoning. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am Jehovah, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. All right. So here we are. We're in the process, you see, of teaching the Egyptians a lesson. God is in charge. So now, finally then, so they come through the dry land, verse 29. The children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on the right hand and on the left. So Jehovah saved Israel. He delivered Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Well, all right. They were a little shaky at the sea there, but turned out all right. They, what does it say? They feared the Lord and they believed the Lord. Well, okay, that's well and good. So, chapter 15, then, you have this great moment of exaltation and celebration, the song of Moses. We sang the song. Number 56, I believe it was, based on these very words. I will sing to the Eternal. He has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has overthrown and thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will exalt him. So, great moment of celebration. And everybody is... excited about the prospect of their current situation. Verse 20, notice. Then Miriam, the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out with their timbrels and with dances, and Miriam answered them, sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. All right, so once again, this is, you know, tremendous opportunity, a tremendous blessing that they have. All right, so then Moses, verse 22, brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Okay, testing continues, all right? Got to learn to trust God. And of course, you're in a desert. You're in the wilderness. And of course, it's dry. It's parched. That's the characteristic of wilderness in this part of the world. So they came to Marah, verse 23, could find no water there. It was bitter. There was water, but it was bitter. So they called the name Marah. And the people complained again against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Well, I guess that's a fair question, isn't it? You're in the desert. You followed God's lead, you know, the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And here we are 3 days into the wilderness, and the water is bitter. All right, so God tests us, you see, because he wants to know what's in our heart. He wants to know just where our allegiance lies. So what shall we drink? So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters were made sweet. There he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them. All right, it's a test. Will you trust God or no? You say, well, it's an interesting solution to bitter waters, isn't it? Well, you just take this tree that I select for you and throw it in the water, and that'll make it sweet. Well, you're talking about a miracle here, and we're not asking you to qualify or to ask for a lengthy explanation of God as to why he's doing things the way he's doing. Just do as you're told, and it'll come out the way you want. So he said, verse 26, "I will diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God, if you will." Again, if. All right? This is contingent on diligently heeding the voice of the Lord and do what is right in his sight. Give ear to his commandments. Keep all his statutes. I will put none of these diseases on you which I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. All right, so they had a test. And again, like I say, there's a series of tests because God wants to know where their heart is. And it's going to be. And now what do we take from this? This isn't just we go back and review the history. There are lessons to be learned. God's going to expect the same kind of things out of us. Allegiance, trust, faith. We will be tested. There are many people that we know of. We get these prayer requests regularly. People who have varying circumstances, many of them related to health issues, perhaps financial issues, any number of things. A wilderness of sorts, if you will. God takes us into the wilderness, and he tests us. All right, so Israel, chapter 16 then. Like I say, the testing begins in earnest. So they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month. All right, so they're a month out into the wilderness now, out of Egypt. And verse 2, then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Well, man, it doesn't seem like we can get through to them in a serious way so that they're convinced that God is doing it for the right reasons and has their benefit in mind. They complained to Moses. And the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Now, of course, it's God that led them out there. So you complain against Moses. They just were following the cloud, and the people came along. They got this far, and now all of a sudden we don't trust God. "You just brought us out here for the purpose of killing us." And so, well, what are you going to do? Well, okay, the story is God gave them manna. And, I'm not deliberately starving you. But then, there again, what's the purpose of the manna? It's to demonstrate to the people that God is capable of providing their needs regardless of the circumstances. Can we learn that lesson? Is that a lesson only for Israel and they failed? Or is that a lesson for us as well? And So hopefully, you know, we'll learn the lessons. The lesson being, can we or will we trust God? Because believe me, and my experience tells me, and, you know, I was a scrapping teenager, age 19, 18, actually, when I first became acquainted with the fact that there was a God. Are you serious? And maybe I better start thinking about reorienting my life. I waited a year to get really serious about it because I had some things I had to get done first. Right. I suppose we all faced that at one point. You know, just give me another year. You know, actually, I wanted two more because I was playing baseball at the University of California, Davis, and man, I wanted more than anything. And I'll keep the Sabbath, you know, 7-8 months out of the year, just, you know, a couple years, then I can do the whole thing. No, you don't do it that way. You have to be willing. You have to come to that place where you recognize whatever it is I thought was my business and what I thought I wanted to pursue in life. Now, here comes God. He's kind of interfering in things. I have to make up my mind. What am I going to do? Am I going to pursue God's way? Am I going to pursue my own way? I mean, that's a lesson we're all faced with. God's going to know, and he will test us. So, as Peter said, you know, later, don't think it's strange concerning the fiery trial that besets you, you know, because these things do happen. God wants to know, where will we be? Will we be loyal, faithful to his purpose? All right, chapter 17 then. All the congregation of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Lord and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people contended with Moses, give us water. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it that you have brought us up out of Egypt? This is it, huh? To kill us with our children and our livestock with thirst? We're having a hard time getting the lesson across to these people that they can indeed trust God. And indeed they must. And indeed we must. So Moses cried out to the Lord, what shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people. Take with you some of the elders. Take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. So, all right. Miraculously, God, through Moses, brought forth a great torrent of water, a river of water. I mean, after all, you got 2 million people and a lot of livestock, you know, you got to have more than a single faucet running, dribbling someplace. You've got to have rivers of water. So God provided for them. And, all right, they were temporarily happy. So, all right, we have the lesson and the experience of Israel and their experiences trying to learn to trust God. Now, let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8. In actual fact, and at least my experience, wouldn't be the days of unleavened bread if we didn't visit Deuteronomy chapter 8. And we get a little more, I think we have a little more insight here into our conditions in our 21st century and what God might expect of us. And the challenge is the same. We have to learn to trust God. We will be tested, all right? So whatever your circumstances, and God will put you in your Red Sea moment, if you will, where clearly the outcome of what you can see is very, very dismal, and you will trust God or bad things happen. So we learn to trust God to lead us through these things. All right, chapter 8. So Deuteronomy now is written 40 years later. They're about ready to actually go into the land of promise. The rebellious nation, or generation rather, has perished in the wilderness. Everybody over the age of 20 is dead. So that means the oldest person that goes into the promised land is what, 60? So, a rather young group, most of them under 40. So they're ready to go. So Moses is going to go through the book of Deuteronomy. He reviews some of these things, points out some of the lessons that they need to learn. And let's take advantage of the opportunity here. All right, chapter 8 now. And this is important, I think, for us. I think this is the challenge for us. Those people, came out of slavery, and, you know, they were very what's the term, needy, I'm going to use the term. They were very concerned about having their basic food and drink provided for them. Now, on the opposite spectrum, now we're going to be tested. We're going to have to go through the same types of trials. But from our point of view here in the 21st century, the challenge for us, we are living in the most affluent time in the history of man. And most assuredly, we have more than enough. The challenge for our generation is, can you accept what is enough and be happy with it? Because none of us have enough. We all have far more than enough when you get right down to it. Now notice what he says, chapter 8. Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your father. All right, the moment's here. Finally, after all the delays and so forth, we're finally lined up and ready to go into the land. But you've got to keep the commandments. You've got to obey God. Verse 2, and you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness. Why? To humble you, to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not, good times and bad times, doesn't matter. Will we dedicate ourselves to God's way or no? And so, in many respects, when you consider that the God of this world is the devil himself, and for all intent and purposes, we are in the wilderness. It's a spiritual wilderness for sure. And there are those occasions when we've all experienced wilderness in the form of whatever, difficulty of one sort or another, illness, financial setbacks, things that are uncertain, and we're not sure whether or not our basic needs are going to be supplied. It's wilderness-like. And God works with us, guides us, and hopefully we learn to trust him and have faith in him. Verse 3, so he humbled you. Aha. Sorry, that's a lesson for all generations. We will be humble. All right? You can underline that one. Put it on your refrigerator. He allowed you to hunger. Oh, he let them get hungry. Yeah, and you know what happens when you get hungry. He fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. All right, Jesus will later quote this from this particular verse as he confronts the devil and his temptation. And there you have it. Life is more than the basic needs, the physical needs. So we must learn to apply and to use the Word of God to the, we need to rely upon that as surely as we rely on our daily bread, if you will. Verse 4, your garments did not wear out, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks. Now notice, now let's think about our current world and what are privileged to enjoy. And because if this is a description of the promised land that Egypt or that the Israelites were about to possess, think of it in terms of our own land and the many wonderful things that God has provided us with. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks, of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of, that flow out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, vines, fig trees, pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing. That pretty well describes 21st century America, Canada, Australia, most of Europe, the developed world, if you will. That's what we're enjoying right now. It wasn't because we necessarily earned it, but this is what God bequeathed upon us so that we could benefit from it. And, of course, God created us curious and clever. And so we've been about the process of, taking advantage of these great resources. All right, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing. Notice, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. Now, I didn't go on to say, but and there's a massive amount of fossil fuels that you'll one day take advantage of. So we've lived in an era that is absolutely unprecedented in the history of mankind. We live better than the average king in previous ages. Now, here's the test for those of us in such a privileged circumstance. Beware, verse 11, that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied. Careful. When your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Now, what do you think? The more affluent we become, the more we have, the less focus there is on God. It seems like, you know, when there's a, I can remember in the drought of 88, I was in Omaha at the time, and this was a serious drought in the Midwest, and there was a time when there was so little water in the upper Mississippi River that they had to stop barge traffic. And in the evening news, here these little brown church in the Vale, I mean, people were gathering, praying for rain in hard times. All people come together in hard times. Beware, he said, lest when you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them and so forth, your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. All right? Who led you through the wilderness, in which there were fiery serpents and scorpions, in the thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. You know, it's hard to acknowledge at the time, but God works with us, he tests us, he humbles us, and the whole purpose is not so he can make us, squirm or whatever. He's trying to do us good. He has a purpose in mind, and he's working with us, and he desires us to be available, to be there, to do it his will. So, verse 18, you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the power to get wealth, and he that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. Then it shall be, if you by any means forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day, you shall surely perish. If we obey God, we can expect the benefits of God. If we don't, we can expect to perish. It's just that simple. It's that black and white. As the nations which the Lord destroys before you, so you shall perish, because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord your God. Well, you know, here we are, how many years removed from the story of Israel coming out of Egypt. And you know, God, you know, he's not discouraged, not deterred from his purpose and accomplishing what he wants to do. And he will have his nation of king, or his kingdom of priests. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 5, and we're going to close here. You know, through it all, and the ups and the downs, and sometimes it seems impossible, we don't know the answer, sometimes we're confused, and sometimes we suffer doubt, and we struggle with these things. And the bottom line is, you know, we have to run the whole race. I mean, what else can we say? And when you're in troubled times, when God leads you into the wilderness and you're humbled and you're uncertain as to the outcome, you know, that's when, you know, we really get in tune with God and his purpose, and we learn to trust him. So what does it say? We have an insight into the very throne room of God. Chapter 5, verse 1. And I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll written inside and on the back sealed with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals?" No one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look at it. So I wept much because no one was found worthy to open the scroll. Then one of the elders told me, "Don't weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and loose the seven seals." And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures, and in the midst of the elders stood a Lamb. This is the Lamb of God slain from the foundation of the world. Now in a position where he is working with God from God's heavenly presence. There stood a Lamb as though it had been slain. Yes, that's right. That's what's made the difference. That's what has liberated us from the grip of sin and death. All right, so he had seven heads and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out in all the earth. Then he came and took the scroll out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. All right, it's God that's sitting on the throne. The Lamb takes the scroll. Now, verse 8. Now, when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp, golden bowls full of incense, and the prayers of the saints, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, okay, now, these are the 24 elders and the four living creatures are singing a song in the very throne room of God. And what are they singing? You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain. All right, that's the difference, okay? Without that, nothing works. But you were slain, and you have redeemed us to God by your blood. Now, the four living creatures and the 24 elders weren't redeemed by the blood. They didn't need to be redeemed. They're referring to you and me, the human beings, out of every tribe, you see, and tongue, and people, and nation, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. Well, now, brethren, that's it. We are in the process of being tested. God is going to test us. He's going to work with us. He's going to humble us. But the end result is God is going to have his kingdom of priests. God is indeed going to select a bride for his firstborn son. And we are privileged to be a part of that nation and a part of that bride. So, brethren, it's a great privilege to be a part of it, to understand it. So let's proceed with a high hand, looking to God through whatever trial and test we may currently be faced. The end is positive, and it will be God's purpose that finally prevails.